And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. So call up your friends who are anywhere around the planet and tell them to tune in. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today my guests are Caroline Levitt and Gail Brandeis. First up is Caroline Levitt. She's the author of 8 novels, Girls in Trouble, Coming Back to Me, Living Other Lives, Into Thin Air, Family, Jealousies, Lifelines, and Meeting Rosie Halfway. Various titles were optioned for film, translated into different languages, and condensed in magazines. Her essays and articles have appeared in Salon, Parenting, The San Francisco Chronicle, The Chicago Tribune, Parents, McCall's, Red Book, Mademoiselle, on and on. She won first prize in Red Book Magazine's Young Writers Contest for her short story, Meeting Rosie Halfway, which grew into the novel. She's the recipient of a 1990 New York Foundation of the Arts Award for Fiction for Into Thin Air, and was also a National Magazine Award nominee for Personal Essay and a judge for the 1990 Fiction Competition for the Writer's Voice Awards in New York City. She teaches writing the novel online for UCLA Extension Program and writes a monthly column on books for A Reading Life in the Boston Globe Sunday book section. Caroline Levitt lives in Hoboken, New Jersey, with her husband, the writer Jeff Tamarkin, and their 7-year-old son, Max, and an extremely cranky tortoise. And her latest book is Girls in Trouble, and that is what we're going to be talking about today. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to talk to you finally.
You too.
Your book I found quite moving and complicated. Will you talk about how it came about, what sparked the idea for Girls in Trouble?
Well, shortly after the birth of our son, I couldn't have any more children, and my husband and I decided we were going to explore adoption. And we had friends who had done open adoption, which is where the birth parents and the adoptive parents know each other, and they decide how much contact they're going to have. And we gave ourselves a year to do it, and in that year, I must have spoken to about 50 or 60 birth mothers, and one thing that struck me was, in all our conversations, that these birth mothers seemed to be yearning for something more than just a good mother for their babies. They seemed to be yearning for acceptance and approval, and I almost got the feeling that they wanted me to adopt them. So I spent hours and hours talking to these girls about things like makeup and clothes and food and all sorts of things that weren't really germane to my adopting their child. In the end, we were heartbroken that we weren't chosen, and the one birth mother that we really wanted to choose us chose somebody else. But I couldn't forget these girls, and so I started writing about them, and that's how the book came about.
It seems like it might have been a difficult book to do in that it's so you had such a personal connection with the story or with the experience of what it would be like. Was it difficult, or are you able to separate yourself from
it? It was difficult. There were times when it was an absolute nightmare, because it was very, very hard. Because when I was writing the adoptive mother, Eva, who was getting rejected time and time again by the birth mothers, it really struck a chord with me. But at the same time, when I was writing Sarah, who's the birth mother, who's really the heroine of the book, I felt that I was tunneled so deeply into her character that I was feeling what she was feeling. So the whole time I was writing the novel, I was either yearning or upset or angry because I was feeling the same thing my characters were. It was really a hard book to write.
Do you relate more to one character than another?
You know, I really don't. I sort of felt that I was inhabiting all of them. I loved Sarah, and I also loved Eva, the birth mother, and I also loved Anne, who was the daughter. And I think, certainly like most writers, there were parts of me in each of those characters.
Yeah, interesting. Well, what about the structure? I'm always curious about structure, how you go from idea or premise to the actual book. Did you know how it was going to go when you started writing?
No, I didn't. All I knew was that it was going to be a book about an open adoption. There was going to be a birth mother and an adoptive mother, and there was going to be a huge conflict where they would be separated, and that somehow they would come together at the end. And the initial draft of the novel actually was very different from how it ended up. When I did my first draft, I showed it to a few of my writer friends, and they all hated it. I mean, one of them told me, you know, every writer has a bad book in them, and maybe this one is yours.
Really?
And you should burn it. And I was really, really upset, and I, you know, I cried, and I sat down, and, you know, I just tried to re-outline it and figure out, why isn't it working? Why are they hating it? I love this idea. Why doesn't anybody else? And I literally rewrote it. Must have been like 5 or 6 or even 7 times until it started opening up and I realized, oh, okay, this is the structure that I want.
Interesting. How long did that take?
Oh, forever. It must have taken 3.5 to 4 years. The book had been sold already and I had to get two 6-month extensions to finish it.
Huh. So, well, that's unusual that it had been sold already. Is that probably
right,
because you have other novels out or?
Well, I had a two book deal.
I see.
And they had the first book, they bought when it was a complete manuscript, and then they gave me a contract for another book. And usually how that works is you show them an outline in a first chapter. And that part I was able to do. I liked my first chapter and the outline was fine. They just want to, you know, make sure that you have some vague idea of what you're going to do. And then once I did the draft, my first draft, I realized I was in trouble and I was going to have to do a whole lot of more rewriting.
Interesting. Huh. Well, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Caroline Levitt, who is author of Girls in Trouble, published by St. Martin's Press, and Piatkis. It was published in the UK as well as here.
Yes, and in Greece, too.
Interesting.
And Sweden, too.
I love it. You know, getting back to structure, and I find it interesting because mostly all women I talk to don't outline their books. I would say probably more male authors seem to outline than women. Do you find this to be the case too? You teach writing and you have all these novels out. What do you think? I mean,
well,
is it a gender thing?
I don't really know. I mean, most of my students at UCLA, and I have private students also, they always hate outlines. And I find that outlines for me are tremendously helpful after I've done a complete first draft, because to me an outline can pinpoint where you need to go and what's your weak area and what isn't. And I just tell my students, you know what, you're never going to really follow your outlines, but that's not their purpose. Their purpose is for those moments when you're surrounded with 500 pages of draft and you have no idea where the spine of the story is. And that's when, if you start outlining, that character A goes to this place in Act 1. And when you're in the center of the novel, maybe this character should be doing that. That's when outlines can be helpful. I haven't really found that it's more for one gender than another. I've actually found that all the writers I know use them and hate them, but use them anyway.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, in terms of your revisions on this book, is it more, you know, pass after pass reveals the bones of the story or where the story needs to go, or what happened during that time? I mean, you know, as you went through draft after draft, how did the story come together? Was it working in your subconscious, do you think, or what was going on?
It's exactly in the subconscious. I think you hit it right on the head. What happened was I just had to tunnel deeper and deeper into each character, and I spent a lot of times doing writing that never found its way in the book. I had characters write letters to me. I had characters write diary entries just so I could figure out what it was that they wanted and why they weren't getting it and what their relationship to each other was. And I really found that the more that I got into my characters' heads and the more that I felt that I was them and I was living their lives through them, then the book started to breathe and it started to open up. And then I started to know, oh, you know, well, that's why it wasn't working in the first draft, because that character shouldn't be doing that. She should actually probably be doing this. And the whole process began to feel almost magical. It became much more organic and much easier, but it took a whole lot of drafts to get there.
So how far in did it start feeling like that? I mean, was the first year just a big question mark and something just kept pushing you on or what?
It's something always kept pushing me on. The first year people were telling me to abandon the book, but I couldn't let it go because I just was in love with the idea and I was in love with the whole topic. And I had a first chapter that I loved and that everybody else seemed to like also, and I couldn't let it go. I would say that I didn't start to feel better until after 2.5 years. And I know, it's terrible. It sounds terrible. But the only reason that I was able to go that 2.5 years is because that's my process. I mean, it's happened this way for me every book. I would start to get upset and my husband would walk in and say, you must be halfway through the book because this halfway through every book you always get like this and I know you can, work it through. So I sort of knew that even though it was terrible and it felt that I'd never see the light at the end, that I would if I could just keep, doing this tunneling and moving forward. But it took a really long time. I just sort of had faith that I was going to finish it and I was going to find the key to it and I was going to make it as good as I could.
Have you abandoned projects after you've put, a good amount of time or pages into them, or do you just stick it out?
I usually stick it out. I usually stick it out. The only things that I've ever abandoned have been short stories. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't seem like such a major loss to me as much as a novel would be.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Caroline Levitt, author of Girls in Trouble, published by St. Martin's Press. The peak emotional point came at just the right place, and, we're getting toward the end here of the book, and I found it so emotional. I don't want to give away the ending, but I'm curious about that this worked so well and how you worked it. I mean, did the climax and the emotional peak of the story, was that something that you kept working at, or did that just come together as your story came together? It seemed like the pacing, everything was just right.
Oh, I can't believe you. Thank you so much for saying that. It took a whole lot of work. It was very, very difficult. I had no idea what to do in the last part of the novel, especially the last remaining scenes. I knew that everybody was going to sort of have to come together, but I didn't really know how or what they would do. And I just kept writing a whole lot of different false endings, and by that I mean endings that I knew weren't the correct ending, but I just sort of wanted to play around and I was hoping that something would tip the scales that way. Rewriting the ending took me the longest of anything because I couldn't get it to feel right, and I would try tricks. I would try to over-dramatize it and do these really huge, melodramatic endings that I knew I wasn't going to use, and then I would try to pare those down, and then I would try to do very minimalist endings and then try to build those up. And it just sort of, after rewriting and rewriting, my subconscious came through for me and something evolved that seemed natural and organic.
I think all this is encouraging. I mean, I don't think it's crazy at all. I think it's very encouraging that you went through such turmoil over writing this and that you stuck it out and that you were successful. I mean, goodness knows, you have gotten a trillion wonderful reviews for this book. And so obviously, you knew what the right thing was to do and you stuck it out, because I think too soon, too early in the process, too many writers give up.
Absolutely. I have, my students are always upset because, whenever they hit a point where they can't make it work, they assume that means that they're not good writers. And I always tell them, no. On the contrary, that's part of the business. That probably means that you are a good writer because you're digging deep and you're going through your subconscious, and just keep at it and you'll see and you'll have success. I think it's a mistake to believe that a writer sits down and they sit at their typewriter, their computer, and, 2 hours later, a brilliant, perfect novel comes out. None of my friends who are novelists have easy time with their writing. We all struggle.
Yeah, I think somehow writers come up with the idea that it should be easy, and if it's difficult, then they're not really a writer. That
right.
Real writers would have an easier time.
Right. Well, sometimes I feel, I mean, sometimes when I'm in the depths of writing and it's really difficult, I do entertain the thought that every other writer on the planet is having a really easy time of it that day, except for me. But I know that it's not true.
Will you read to us?
Excuse me?
Will you read to us?
Oh, yes, I'd love to. I'd love to.
And if you just tuned in, I am with Caroline Levitt, author of Girls in Trouble, and she's about to read.
Okay, the part that I'm going to be reading is from the beginning of the novel, and all you have to know about it is that Sarah is the young birth mother. She's 16. She is on the fast track to Harvard when she's gotten pregnant, and Abby is her mother, and Abby wants her to go to an adoption agency and give up the baby. Abby had gone to the agency with Sarah and looked through the photo albums of couples wanting her baby, read the ridiculous letters that all seemed the same. Dear birth mother, we know how brave a sacrifice you're making. The handwriting spiked and curlicued. The paper was always soft blue. We want you to know we'll love your baby the same way you would. The words were insinuating to Sarah, as though these people knew something about her. The photographs they sent were even worse. Bland-faced couple staring out at her. Here we are at the beach, but we love the city, too. One couple posed with two big dogs on their bed. Every child needs a dog or two. This is Scruffy. He loves kids. All those 800 numbers they gave Sarah so you wouldn't know where these people were calling from or how they might lie to you. She wouldn't let her parents be around her when she called the 800 numbers, though they offered. We can help you, Abby said. I know just the questions you should ask. But Sarah shook her head. If she were going to give something up, if she were going to ruin her life, then she wanted to ruin it all on her own. She sat upstairs, her heart racing, the door firmly closed. She spoke to the women, who cracked back jokes, who were eager to please, who said her name in every sentence, over and over like an incantation. And then one day, Sarah was having a conversation with a woman in Maine when the woman blurted, "Who's the father, Sarah? Do you realize why I need to know?" And then Sarah heard the woman sigh. "Oh, God, I'm sorry. I don't really want to denigrate you." The woman cleared her throat. I mean, I didn't intend that remark in a bad way. "In a pejorative way, do you mean?" Sarah asked. "Oh," the woman said, "whoops. I know what denigrate means. I'm an honor student." "Good, good," the woman laughed politely. "And I know who the father is." "Good, good," the woman said again, relieved, but Sarah never called her back. The adoptive couple skirted around her, acting like she was white trash or stupid. Their voices were fake and bright as tinsel. Chatting, they told her they were having fried chickens or McDonald's. There was shake and bake night, even as she heard a male voice in the background whisper, "Honey, where's the creme fraiche?" These people lied outright to her. They were trying to turn themselves into whatever they thought she wanted. "Are you religious?" Sarah asked. Not that she cared, but she just wanted to know. We're spiritual," said one woman. "They're lying to me," Sarah said to the adoption agency, but the adoption agent shrugged. "You have to realize these people are yearning for a baby. They let their common sense fly out the window. You let us find out the truth." "When are you going to make a decision?" Abby prodded Sarah. She wanted Sarah to choose a family who lived in Texas, who had a big dog and who said they'd be happy to send pictures, but just for a year. "What's wrong with these people?" Jack said, pointing to an album from a family who were moving to Spain. And then, like an afterthought, the agency had sent over George and Eva's scrapbook. "I don't know if this is right for you," the agency said, "but it's worth a shot." Abby hadn't liked George and Eva the moment she saw their scrapbook. "They look like hippies," she said, pointing to Eva's filmy long dress, George's cowboy boots. She shook her head at the picture of Eva with her preschool class, all of them, especially Eva, covered in poster paints. Abby said they were too old for Sarah. They were in their 40s, for God's sakes, 43. Abby was 43, and you didn't see her talking about having a baby now, did you? Plus, they were too close, just 20 minutes away. "This isn't a good idea," Jack said. But Sarah liked the way they looked. She wanted to choose them. And that's the passage from the beginning of the book.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Gosh, we have a little bit of time left and too much to talk about. This always happens, and I don't like it at all. But, gosh, a few more minutes. What can we talk about other than 2 million things? Well, you know, I want to get back to the reviews because your reviews have been so excellent. And I imagine this isn't your problem because the reviews have been so excellent. But what do you do with reviews? I mean, what if you got a bad one? Or do you just not read them?
I have gotten bad reviews. In fact, I remember It was not for this particular book, but I still remember to this day a review I got for my third novel, which started out more psychopathology masquerading as fiction from the tiresome Miss Leavitt. And I stayed in my apartment for a week. I was so ashamed and I felt so terrible. And part of the good thing about reviewing books for the Boston Globe now is that I look at reviews differently now because I realize it's one person's point of view and that most reviewers try to be, you would hope that they would try to be kind. And if I have a good review, I'm thrilled. And if I have a bad review, I just tell myself, well, you know what, that particular reviewer didn't like the book. It doesn't mean that other people won't. And the important thing is to get the reviews. Mm-hmm. And all publicity is publicity. But it's never pleasant.
Hmm. What about the promotional aspect? Because you're one of the most upbeat authors that I've been in contact with who is just very pleasantly upbeat and pleasantly in touch, never sort of hitting you over the head about if you don't have me on your show or do something with me,
you know,
there's all kinds of things that happen. Or authors that just don't follow up at all. You're nicely balanced with how you promote yourself. Is that something you had to learn, or is it difficult?
I had to learn it, and I actually had an excellent teacher. A college friend of mine became a PR person, and when I first started out and I was trying to figure out how was I going to, you know, help my publicist promote my book, my friend said, well, you know, there's a lot that you can do, and, you know, you just have to do it in a way that's not heavy-handed, in a way that's pleasant, and she gave me a whole lot of tips. And I also found that with my job at the Boston Globe, I get contacted by a lot of authors and a lot of PR people, and you can tell when somebody's being honest and humble, or when they really love a book, or when they're just giving you, you know, the basic PR pitch. And I found that I was going to use to promote myself the things that people used for me that I responded to. I mean, if I had one person call me up and say, you know, I wrote this book and it's a really wonderful book and I don't think it's going to get any press and could I have my publicist send it to you? And it just seemed like such an honest thing to me that I said, okay, yeah, you know, sure, you can send it to me. And I ended up loving the book, just loving the book. I just think, you know, if you're honest and if you're humble and if you're not too pushy, and I think you have to be willing to hear no and not expect yes and still stay very, very nice.
Sure. Hard thing to do.
Yes.
I would imagine, you know, and when it's you doing the contact, making the contacts, and, you know, to stay positive and not take it personally.
It's very hard not to take it personally, but you have to. I mean, there's so many books coming in, and I, you know, at any given day, I have a zillion books coming in, and sometimes books just, they get bumped or they get lost in the shuffle, and it isn't because they're not wonderful books. So
yeah.
I tell myself, well, that must be the same for mine.
Yes. Well, I sure appreciate you coming on the show.
And I so appreciate your having me. This is so wonderful.
Come back for your next novel or whatever you write next. Come back.
I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Caroline.
Bye-bye.
That was Caroline Leavitt, author of Girls in Trouble, published by St. Martin's Press. She has a website, which is carolinelevitt.com, CaroLineLeavitt. .com. So visit her website. There's lots of good stuff on it. When we come back, we'll be here with Gail Brandeis. Don't go anywhere. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we were here the first half of the show with Caroline Leavitt, author of Girls in Trouble. And now we are back with Gail Brandeis, who is author of Fruit Flesh. Gail's first novel, Book of Dead Birds, was awarded the 2002 Bellwether Prize. Her poetry, essays, and fiction have appeared in dozens of magazines and anthologies and have received numerous awards, including the Story Magazine Short Story Award and a grant from the Barbara Deming Memorial Fund. Gail Brandeis lives in Riverside, California, with her husband and two children. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Fruit Flesh is such a wonderful, wonderful book. about writing, and it's for women who write. Will you talk about how this book came about and how you slanted it for women?
Sure. Well, the book really was inspired by a strawberry, and the first sentence of the book is, "A strawberry changed my life," and it's so true. A strawberry did change my life. In high school, I had been very ill and very disconnected from my body, and my philosophy teacher my senior year brought a strawberry into class for each student, and she had us do a meditation with the strawberry where we had to experience it with all our senses but taste for 5 minutes, and all of a sudden I felt like I was more fully awake than I had ever been in my life. I felt like my senses were suddenly open for the first time, and I felt as if I'd never really smelled anything before, I'd never really touched anything before, and through the strawberry, I woke up. And I had always been a writer. I started writing when I was 4 years old. But that strawberry made me realize that my writing needed to engage the senses and the body. And I became obsessed after that with the connection between writing and the body. And after I went off to school to go to college, I focused on writing and dance and tried to find ways that they would intersect, and the body was where they intersected, because language arises from the body and movement arises from the body, and I wanted to find a language that was as muscular as dance could be.
Interesting. So was it a natural that it would become a book for women?
When I first started writing it, I wasn't thinking about gearing it primarily towards women. The book really underwent a lot of changes over the course of the process of writing it. When I first started, it was very sort of theoretical and abstract and very research-oriented about the connection between writing and the body. And my agent started sending it out, and we had a lot of nice feedback, but a lot of the editors said, "We like this, but there's not enough of the author in it." And I rewrote it almost as a memoir because I thought that made sense, that the reader would want to know about my experience since it was so much about writing in the body. And this time the editor sent it back saying, "We like this, but there's too much of the author in it." And I was a little bit confused at that point about what to do. And somewhere around this time, or actually earlier, there was a book called Writing from the Body that came out by a man named John Lee. And I was really upset to hear that this book came out, because I thought that I had something new to share with the world, that no one else had discovered this connection between writing and the body. And I suppose it's kind of, that was a little bit arrogant of me to think that, because, you know, certainly other people have come up with that thought. But after I looked at his book, I realized that there was still room for what I had to say. And I also realized, too, that he is a man and lives in a man's body, and I live in a woman's body, and that's what I know most intimately, and I thought that that would be what I could share most intimately. And it's so important to me to help women in our culture feel more comfortable and at home in our skin, because our culture really does not encourage that. We see so many images of how our bodies are supposed to look, and it, I think, teaches us to really feel uncomfortable with our bodies and to feel as if our bodies are wrong if we have a little bit of cellulite or hair in the wrong place and if we're not a Barbie doll. And so I really wanted to write the book to help women delve deep into their own skin and deep into the wisdom that's inside all of our bodies.
And yet I hear that your book, Fruit Flesh, is very appealing to men.
Yeah, I've had a really lovely response from men, and I'm grateful for that. I think that there are really only a few chapters that are focused primarily on women's anatomy. And we all have senses, and we all live in bodies on this earth. And I actually had a man tell me that he thinks that men have a harder time living in their bodies than women do, because of women's cycles and things like that. We're very grounded in the body, and it's easy for men to just live in their heads. And that was something I hadn't thought of before, because I was so focused on the media and how the media treats women. And so it was nice to to get a positive response from men who really felt like this helped them access a juicier creativity than they had done primarily before.
Yes. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Gail Brandeis, author of Fruit Flesh, Seeds of Inspiration for Women Who Write, published by Harper San Francisco. You went from doing this book on writing to writing a novel.
Yeah.
And the Book of Dead Birds, and it won the Bellwether Prize. Is that unusual to have a successful nonfiction book and then have your publisher welcome a novel?
I'm not sure how unusual it is. I think it's unusual for someone's first book to be a book about writing. And I think that I sort of sneaked by in that regard because in some ways I felt a little bit guilty about writing this book because I thought, who am I to tell people how to write? And at that point I had published a lot in magazines and anthologies, so I had made a very tiny name for myself, although I don't think many people had heard of me, but I felt like I was sharing something that really deeply came out of my own process. But as I was writing Fruit Flesh, I also was writing fiction and poetry, and The Book of Dead Birds is my fourth novel that I've written, although it's the first one to be published.
That's encouraging. Talk about that.
Okay. Well, I had always considered myself a poet first, because I started writing poetry when I was four, and my undergraduate degree is in poetry. And when my daughter was born 10 years ago, fiction just kind of started pouring out of me, and I wasn't expecting it. I really had never thought fiction would be a genre I'd feel comfortable with. And these three novels just kind of flew out of me in very quick succession after her birth. And I had no idea what I was doing. I just trusted the flow of it, but once I had a draft out, I had no idea what to do with it, and that was the case with all three of these novels. And when I started writing The Book of Dead Birds, I realized that I wanted to write it in a more conscious way, and in a way that was more fully crafted and a little, not less intuitive. I wanted it to continue to be intuitive, but I wanted to bolster up that intuitiveness with some real nuts and bolts. And so I decided to go back to school and get my MFA. And I wrote this novel as my thesis.
So did the MFA come before or after Fruit Flesh?
I was writing Fruit Flesh while I was doing the MFA.
I see.
But I had started it beforehand.
Interesting. Oh, well, once again, and you heard Caroline's interview, you know,
yes,
just that
my
persistence.
Wonderful friend Caroline.
That persistence aspect is something all writers really need to grow and nurture.
Definitely, and it was actually very helpful to hear you and Caroline speak about that because I'm at a point with my new novel where I'm really feeling like, oh, it's garbage and I should just throw it away, and I know it's kind of like that moment when you're giving birth and transition, when you just think you're going to die and that you just can't get through it, and that's shortly before the baby's actually born.
Yeah.
And I have to keep reminding myself that because it's so tempting to just throw something away when it's not working. And I know that I need to just go deeper and to stay with it. And I feel like I've kind of lost track of the book's heartbeat, but I know it's there somewhere. So it was very helpful to hear you speak about that.
So how do you know then? Because as you said, you wrote three novels.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to give up on some. Mm-hmm. And yet you persisted with The Book of Dead Birds, and it went on to not only get published, but win a prize. So how do you know? How do you know when you should soldier on, or when you should just say, you know what, this has been a learning experience, and I'm going to put it aside?
Oh, gosh. You know, that's a hard question to answer. It's a very intuitive thing, I think. And, you know, so much of Fruit Flesh is about tapping into the body as a source of creativity. And for me, I like to tap into the body throughout the process as sort of a touchstone. And I find that I know in my body if I need to stick with something. And I don't know if I can articulate that in a way that will make any sense. But it's almost as if the project makes my breath change. And if I don't feel that physical connection, maybe that's when it's time to let it go.
Huh. So it's more something you feel as opposed to being in your head.
Yeah, I think so. Although the head certainly comes into it as well.
Hmm.
But with the Book of Dead Birds, I was ready to give up on it a couple of times, and then some really sort of magical things ended up happening where a dead bird appeared on my patio one day after I had decided, okay, I'm done with this book, and I'm going to throw it away. And I thought, well, that's a sign I need to keep going. And the book, I was writing it in the third person at first, and it felt very flat, and it didn't feel quite right, but I thought, well, this bird came to me, I need to keep going. And then I came down with a high fever when I had strep throat and ended up having these hallucinatory fever dreams where I became my main character. And after the fever broke, I realized that she needed to tell the story in her own voice. And as soon as I started rewriting it in the first person, it really came to life for me.
And at what point in the process was that?
That was quite far into the process. That was towards the end of my MFA program. I had been working on the book intensively for 2 years, and I'd actually started it 3 years before that. So I was probably, oh gosh, well, I was almost finished with an entire first draft. And then, well, it wasn't exactly first draft because I had done a lot of changes before then. But I threw that all away and started from scratch, writing it in the first person.
Interesting. So you didn't look at what you had and just go through and do a search and replace? And
No. I felt like I couldn't do that because I needed to find her voice. And if I just replaced she with I, her voice wouldn't be there.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I hear authors say this all the time, that they'll just begin completely over again, however many times it takes.
Mm-hmm. And it's a scary thing to do that. Because, you know, you pour so much effort and time and heart and sweat into a draft, and then to just have to let it go can be pretty painful. That's what happened with the novel that I'm working on. I finished the first draft a couple of months ago and realized that it just wasn't working, that I hadn't found the right form for it, and I hadn't quite found the right voice. And I'm not sure I'm there yet. I think I'm closer now with this draft, but I have a feeling I have a lot of work ahead of me still.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with Gail Brandeis, author of Fruit Flesh, Seeds of Inspiration for Women Who Write, and also author of The Book of Dead Birds. Do you plot your fiction?
No, I'm not a plotter or an outliner. One of my mentors at my MFA program had me outline the story, and I resisted it. She had to drag me kicking and screaming into it. And I did write an outline, and it ended up being very instructive for me to see what the arc of the story could be and just to kind of get a sense of the shape of the story. But I threw it away almost immediately. And I like to be open to where the story wants to go. And one of my favorite parts of the process is the surprise and the discovery that sort of unfolds as I keep writing. And if I plotted it too carefully, I'm not sure if I would allow that space for that kind of surprise to happen.
Interesting. You've been mentioning working on an MFA and being a part of that. Do you recommend MFA programs in general, or is it important to just be in a writer's group, or what do you think? I mean, I'm asked this question all the time.
Well, the MFA program, I went to the Antioch Law Residency program, and it was perfect for me. I think, you know, each person needs to find the type of program that's right for them. But in this case, it was great because I could do most of the work at home. I was writing at home anyway. And then I had these 2 10-day intensive residencies a year, which were so inspiring and exciting and exhausting. And it would be 10 days of readings and workshops and seminars from 9 in the morning until 9 at night. And it was really wonderful for me to become part of a community of writers. I had some friends who were writers, but I felt fairly isolated as a writer before I started the program. And it was really helpful to get other people's feedback and also to learn to hone my own sort of internal radar to determine whether feedback resonated with me or not, because some feedback just didn't ring true, and other feedback really rang a bell, and I thought, yes, you know, that, you know, people can point out things about our work that we can't see ourselves in a very clear way. Like, one mentor pointed out the fact that I overused the word though, which I had no idea I had done that, and I never would have seen that myself, but now I'm so much more conscious of how I use the word though, and I've met a small number of friends who I know will be friends for life and who I continue to share work with, and they're such excellent readers of my work. But there are definitely other ways to find community as a writer, either through local writing groups or online. Actually, Carolyn and I met each other at Readerville, which is such a wonderful resource for readers and writers online.
And Readerville.com, yes?
Yes, yes. And I, too, have found friends, including Carolyn there, who have become such important support for me, and we share work with each other and share support and commiseration with each other, and Carolyn and I are constantly contacting each other for a little boost when we're feeling low in our writing process.
And you have a website too.
Yes.
Will you give that?
Sure. It's www.gailebrandeis.com, and that's GAYLEBRANDEIS. And be sure you put the www, because if you don't, it goes to my husband's joke site, which is the server for my site.
Oh, we can go there,
very
too.
It's confusing. It's a site of about chickens and has nothing to do with my work at all.
That's funny. Will you read to us from Fruit Flesh?
Sure.
And if you just tune in again, I'm with Gail Brandeis. She's about to read from Fruit Flesh, Seeds of Inspiration for Women Who Write.
Okay, I'm going to read one of the Fruit Flesh meditations. I have these meditations scattered throughout the book, and each one focuses on a specific fruit and a specific aspect of creativity. This one is the ugly fruit. The ugly fruit is the only fruit with a trademarked name. The citrus fruit hails from Jamaica, but the name hails from Canada, where there was a great demand for more of that ugly fruit from the islands. Despite its name, the ugly is not hideous. Its peel is simply less uniformly colored and textured than that of most citrus fruits. It's the size of a grapefruit, mottled on the outside with greens, oranges, and yellows. The pachydermic skin is thick and loose, easy to peel. The flesh inside is juicy, with a sweet, pungent tang. Hold an ugly fruit. Feel how it wears its name loosely, the fruit moving freely beneath the puffy skin. Peel the skin off. Hold the naked fruit in your hand. Feel its wholeness, the dignity it carries beneath its demeaning name. Gently remove a section and bite into the pulp. Taste its true beauty. How have you been trademarked, labeled? How have those labels, good girl, bad girl, and the like, affected you and your work? Have you let yourself embody the labels, the trademarks other people have imposed upon you? Break free of those labels. They are not you. Leave them behind you like a pile of citrus peel. Feel the integrity of your own fruit flesh that pulses underneath. Let yourself blossom into your own rightful name.
Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
Lovely, lovely writing. I think before I ever read your book, I remember talking with my agent, who wasn't my agent at that point, Betsy Amster, and I think we were standing at the L.A. Times Book Festival a couple of years ago, and your name and book came up, and she said, yeah, she's a terrific writer. I said, oh, I got to read this.
Yeah, Betsy Amster is wonderful. She had considered my work early on and decided it wasn't quite the right fit for her, but she was very encouraging and supportive.
Yeah, well, she loved it.
That's great. And you have a book about writing coming out.
Yes,
you?
I do.
Well, I'm very eager to read that.
Yeah, it's gearing up. I'll say that. Will you talk about the structure of your book and how you decided on the quotes and the poems? I love that, the poems at the beginning of some chapters and the nice, you know, bite-sized chapters as well.
Sure. Well, once I had that confusing feedback from the editors about there's not enough you, there's too much you, I set the project aside for a while, and then I just happened to go to an estate sale down the street from our house, and I picked up a print of a woman who looks like the Virgin of Guadalupe, and she's naked, and she's surrounded by watermelon, and it was the Virgin of the Watermelon, and I bought it for $3, and as I was carrying it home, I realized that I needed to bring more fruit into the book, because I had called the earlier drafts Fruit Flesh, but there was only one chapter about fruit in it with my strawberry experience. And so when I realized I needed to bring more fruit into the book, I realized I wanted the structure to mirror that in some way also. And so it's divided into sections that mirror the growth of a fruit tree. So starting with seeds, and then roots, trunk, branches, leaves, buds, flowers, fruit, and then back to seeds again, because I just thought that the book should follow that creative cycle. And after I made that decision, it sort of came together very quickly with the small chapters, and I wanted to include other writers' voices. I didn't want the book to just be my voice, because I'm so inspired and fed by other writers, and I wanted to include some of their voices. So many of the chapters begin with a quote from another poet or author, and I chose a lot of quotes that had fruit in them, and that was really fun. But just the research process of finding fruit-related quotes was great fun for me.
Amazing that there are so many wonderful ones.
Yes.
You know?
I was constantly just oohing and aahing over all this incredible stuff, and it's, you know, such a lovely thing that I can share this wonderful work through my book. And it was quite a process getting permission for all of the quotes. I have about 100 of them, and I hadn't realized what a job I had ahead of me when I decided to do this, because the permissions process is very, very chaotic. There's no rhyme or reason to it, and there was no standard for what publishers would want for work, and so that sort of became a full-time job for a while, but it was worth it because I'm very glad that I can include these other voices.
Yeah, well, it's such a lovely book. And we're at the end of our time. Do you have any words of wisdom for the writers listening who are, working through it, struggling with their own writing? And especially, I guess, for the women listening.
Well, I would say, you know, just keep writing. Find whatever time you can. If you have children, you know, it's always a balance to juggle motherhood and writing. And, you know, if you can sneak a notebook into the bathroom for a few minutes, or I would sometimes write while my babies were nursing when they were babies. And just find a way to work it into your daily life so it's as much a part of your day as brushing your teeth. Read as much as you can, because reading feeds the writing. And take time to really pay attention to the world around you, because I think when we open our senses and take the world in a very clear and deep way, then our writing becomes so much more vivid and alive. So just even taking a couple of minutes to look at a strawberry more closely can open up whole worlds for us in our writing.
As it did with you.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And please come back with your next book, or when the Book of Dead Birds goes into paper.
Well, it just did, actually.
It just
did? They came out together in paperback.
Well, we're going to have to schedule you again.
Okay.
Talk more about that book.
I would love that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Gail Brandeis, author of Fruit Flesh, Seeds of Inspiration for Women Who Write, and the Book of Dead Birds, and she'll be back hopefully in a couple of months to talk about the Book of Dead Birds. Her website again is gailbrandeis.com, www.gailbrandeis.com. Okay, another hour has flown by, a wonderful hour with two wonderful authors. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, go to my website at writersonwriting.com. You can email me from there if you'd like to be on my weekly email list to see who's coming on. And I want to leave you with a quote by Peter Levitt. He's an author of Finger Painting on the Moon. He was on a few months ago. And he said, Poetry is just the universe talking to itself in a language that human beings understand. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.